you're fucking struggling with that fucking baby. A fucking sprinter, that's all you are. A sprinter will never fucking stand the pace with a distance man. No problem, the cunt says, taking a big fucking swig out of the draft pack. He screws his face up. It's hard not to fucking pish myself. The lager's louping. Seems to have gone dead flat, Ken. Tastes like fucking pish. I'm doing my best to hud it in. Stop making fucking excuses, you crapping cunt. I'll still drink it, like, the cunt goes. I tried to look out the window with that daft cunt finishing the fucking lot. I'm really fucking out here by the time we hit King's Cross. The birds have fucked off. I thought we were onto a fucking good thing there and all, and I sort of lost rents coming off the train. I've even got that red-headed cunt's bag instead of my own. That cunt better have mine's. I didn't even ken the fucking address, but then I clocks the red-headed cunt talking to this wee cunt with a plastic cup outside the entrance to the tube. Rents has got my fucking bag. Lucky for him, the cunt. Any change for the boy, Franco? Rents says, and this daft-looking wee cunt huds up the fucking cup, looking at us with the fucking sappy eyes. Get the fuck, you gippo cunt, I says, knocking the cup out of his hand and fucking pishing myself at the daft cunt scrambling around on the deck between cunt's legs to get his fucking coins. Where the fuck's this flat, then? I says to Rents. No far, Rent says, looking at us like I was fucking... The way that cunt looks at you sometimes, he's going to get a sore face one of these fucking days, mates or nae fucking mates. Then the cunt just turns away, and I follow him down onto the Victoria line.
Chapter 16. Nana and Other Nazis.
The fit of Leith Walk is really likes mobbed out, man. It's too hot for a fair-skinned punter likes he ken. Some cats thrive in the heat, but the likes of me ken, we just can't handle it. Too severe a gig, man. Another total downer is being skint likes he. Pure Joe Strummer, man. All you do is walk around and check people out, ken. Every cat's dead, palsy-walsy, likes he. But once they suss at your brassic lint, they sort of just drift away into the shadows. I clock Franco at Queen Sticky Vicky's statue, talking to this big dude, a mean hombre called Lexo. A casual acquaintance, if you catch my drift. Funny scene, likes he, how all the psychos seem to ken each other. Ken what I mean, likes? Such alliances are unholy, man. Just unholy. Spud! All right, you cunt. How's it gone? The beggar is one high cat boy. No so bad, likes he, Franco. Yourself? Barry, he says, turning to this square-shaped mountain beside him. You ken Lexo? A statement, like, say, no a question. I just sort of nods ken, and the big hombre looks at us for a second, then turns and talks to Franco again. I can tell that those cats have, like, say, bin liners to slash open and rubbish to rummage through, so I sort of says, like, got a nash, like, catches later. Hold on, mate. How you fixed? Franco asks us. Basically, man, I'm totally brassic. I've got 32 pence in my pocket and a pound in my account at the Abbey National. No really the kind of investment portfolio to cause the Charlotte Square dude sleepless nights, like say. Franco slips us 2 tenners. Nice one, the beggar boy. Nae skag now, you raj cunt, he gently chides us, like say. Gie us a bell at the weekend, or come down for us well. Did I ever say anything derogatory against my man Franco? Well, like say, he's no a bad punter. Pure jungle cat, ken. But even jungle cats sit down and have a wee part of themselves now and again, like say, usually after they've, like, devoured somebody. I sort of can't help wondering who Franco and Lexo's devoured, like say. Frankie baby was doing in London with Rents, hiding out for the lab dicks. What had the boy been up to? Sometimes it's better not to ken. In fact, it's always better not to ken, like say. I cut through Woolies, which is busy, like, say, really busy. The security dude's engrossed in chatting up this sexy cat girl on the checkout, like, say, so I pocket a set of blank tapes. The pulse races, then slowly dips. It's a good feeling, like, say, the best. Well, maybe second best behind the smack kit and, like, say, coming with a lassie. So good that the adrenaline kick makes us want to head up the toon on a chorion spree, like. The heat, man, is hot. That's the only way you can describe it, Ken. I head for the shore and sit on a bench near the dole office. That double ten spot feels good in my pocket, like, say, opens a few more doors, Ken. So I sit looking at the river. There's a big swan in the river, Ken. I think about Johnny Swan and Gear. This swan, though, is fucking beautiful, likes. I wish I'd got some bread, likes, to feed the punter with. Gav works for the dole. Maybe I'll catch the cat on his lunch break, stand to do the pint or two, likes. I've been bought a few by him lately. I see Ricky Monaghan coming out the dole. An okay gadge, Ken. Ricky. All right, Spud. What you up to? No much gone doing my end, Catboy. You see the whole kit and caboodle, like, say. Bad as that. Worse, Catboy, worse. Still off the collies. 4 weeks and 2 days since my last bit of Salisbury Crag, Ken. Counting every second, man, counting every second. It's tick-tock, tick-tock, like, say, Ken. Feeling better for it. It's like, see, only then that I realise that I am. Bored as fuck, Ken, but physically, like, see, aye. The first fortnight was an extended death trip, man, but now, likes, I could handle some hot sex with a Jewish princess or a Catholic girl, complete with white socks. Gotta be complete with the white socks, Ken. Aye, I do feel sorta better, like, say. Gone Easter Road on Saturday? No. It's been like say donk since I went to the football, Ken. Maybe I could go, though. With Rents. But Rents is in London and now. Or Sick Boy and that. Go with Gav and buy him a couple of pints. See the cabs again. Well, maybe. See how it goes, like say, Ken. You gone? No. I says last season that I wasn't gone back until they got rid of Miller. We need a new manager. Yeah. Miller. We need a new cat in the manager's basket. I didn't even ken where the manager was, Lexi. Couldn't even tell you the names of the cats in the team, Lex. Maybe Kano. But I think Kano might have moved on. Jury! Gordon Jury! Jury's still in the team! Moni just looks at us and kindly shakes his head. No! Jury was transferred ages ago, Spud. 86. Went to Chelsea. Yeah, right, man. Jury, I remember that cat scoring a cracker against Celtic. Or was it Rangers? Same thing, really, though, man. When you think about it, Lexi. Kind of different sides of the same coin, Ken. He shrugs. I doubt I've convinced the cat. Ricky chums us, or it's Lexi, I chums him. I mean, we really kens ways chumming way in this cracked scene these days, man. But whoever's chumming way, it's destination fit of the walk again. Life can be boring without Skag. Rents is in London, Sick Boy's sniffing around up the tune all the time. The famous old port just does not seem to be cool enough for that cat these days. Rab, the second prize likes, has just vanished. And Tommy seems to have gone to ground since he split for that Lizzie chick. That likes he leaves me and Franco. Some life, man, I can tell ye. Ricky, Moni, Richard Monaghan, fellow Fenian freedom fighter, to be sure, likes he fucks off to meet this lemon up the tune. This leaves yours truly on his Jack Jones, likes he. I decide to visit Nana in the sheltered housing gaffs at the bottom Easter Road lights. Nana hates it there, even though she's, like, got a barry pad. Wish I could get one like that, Ken, dead smart, but only for older cats, like, say. You just pull a cord and an alarm goes, and this warden-like comes and sorts it all out for you, Ken. That would be right up my street, man, with Frank Zappa's daughter. That crazy chick, the Valley Girl, Moon Unit Zappa as warden, like, say. A dead peachy scene that would be, I kid you not, Catboy. Nana spins her fucked up lights, and the quack says that it was too rage, her struggling up to the top flight of stairs in her old gaff at Lornstrasse. Too right, heap big medicine man. If you took the varicose veins out of Nana's legs, like say, there would be nae legs. Nothing to hud her up, Ken. I've got better veins in my arms than she's got in her scrambled eggs. She still gave the doc some stick, likes. All cats have been marking out their territory, so to speak, for likes he donks and get attached to it. Sure as fuck, they are nae gonna gear up without a scrap. Claws come out and fur flies, man. That's Nana. Miss Muscuri, as I call her, Ken. There's a common room for her block, like say, which Nana never uses, unless she's trying to cruise that Mr. Bryce. The old punter's family complained to the warden about her sexually harassing them. This warden wifey tries to mediate, likes, between Mama and Mr. Bryce's daughter, but Nana reduces the daughter to tears by making snide remarks about the bad birthmark on her face. Sort of one of the Weinsteins, Ken. It's like, say, that Nana picks on people's weaknesses, particularly other women, and uses that against them, Ken. A series of different locks click open, and Nana smiles at us and gestures us to come in. I get a barry reception here, but Mama and sister get greeted like, well, like, say, nothing. They do everything for Nana and all. But Nana loves guys and hates lassies. She's had, like, say, 8 bairns by 5 different men, Ken. And that's just the ones we ken about. Hello, Callum, Willie, Patrick, Kevin, Desmond. She lists the name of some of her grandchildren, still likes missing out mine. Doesn't it bother me, though, like, say. I get called Spud that often, even Mama calls us it. I sometimes forget my name too. Danny. Danny, 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 Danny. And I call Kevin Danny a no. How could I forget that, young Danny boy? Well, likesy, how could she? Danny boy and Rosie's e Picardy are likesy the only song she kens, Ken. She sort of sings at the top of her voice, a breathless, tuneless sound, with her arms sort of raised into the air for effect, Ken. George's here. I look around the bend of the L-shaped room and clock my Uncle Dodd, slumped in a chair, sipping a canny tenant's lager. Dodd, I says, Spud, all right, boss, how you living? Peachy, Catboy, peachy, yourself, I say. Can't complain. How's your ma? Still likes he getting on my case as usual, Ken. Hey, that's your mother you're talking about. The best friend you'll ever have. Is that no right, ma? He asked Nana. Bucking right it is, son. Bucking is one of Nana's favourite words, likes he, along with pish. Nobody says pish like Nana. She sort of drags out the shh. It's like, see, you can see the steam rising off the yelly jet as it hits the white porcelain, Ken. Uncle Dodd gives her a big, indulgent sort of grin. Dodd's like, see, half-caste, the son of a West Indian sailor, Ken, the product he likes, West Indian seaman, Ken. Dodd's old boy pulled into Leith long enough to get Nana up the kite. Then it was back to the Seven Seas. Sounds a good life, lights, a sailor's. Like, say, a bird in every port in that. Dodd's Nana's youngest bairn. She married my grandad first, lights, a chancing old cowboy fae County Wexford. The old dude used to sit Mama on his lap and sing to her Irish rebel songs, like, say. He had hair growing out his nostrils, and she thought that he was ancient, the way ankle biters do, likes. The gadge could only have been in his 30s, like. Anyway, This gad sort of blew it likes, kindy fell for the top flare windy of the tenement. He was shagging this other woman at the time, no Nana likesy. Nobody could really tell whether it was drunkenness, suicide, or likesy, well, both. Anyway, that yin left her with three bairns, including Mama. Nana's next married man was a gravel-voiced dude who had once worked as a scaffolder, ken. The old boy's still on the scene in Leith. The gadge once told us in a pub that scaffolding was classed as a trade now, likes. Rents, who was a chippy at the time, told the boy that that was a load of shite, that he was semi-skilled, and the boy took the cream puff, likes, eh? I still sometimes see him up the volley, likes. He's not a bad old punter. Lasted a year with Nana, but produced a bairn with another on the way, likes he. Wee Alec, the co-op insurance man, who'd just been widowed, was Nana's next victim, likes he. They said that Alec thought, Ken, that the bairn Nana was carrying was his. He lasted 3 years, likes he, gaining her another bairn, before the pair dude stormed out, after likes he catching her shagging another guy in the house. He sort of likes waited for the boy in the stair, or so the story goes, likes he, with this bottle. The guy pleaded for mercy. Alec put the bottle down, saying that he didn't likes need a weapon to sort the likes of that boy out. The gadge's expression sort of changed, and he booted Pear Alec all over the stair, dragging the pear cat into the walk, dazed and likes he covered in blood, before flinging him onto a pile of rubbish stacked on the curb outside a grocer's shop. My mother says that Alec was, likes he, a decent wee man. He was, ken, the only cat in Leith we didn't ken that Nana was on the game, likes he. The last but one bairn Nana had was a real mystery, likes he. That's my auntie Rita, who's much nearer my age than my ma's. I suppose if I was had the hots for Rita, a cool chick, dead sort of 60s, ken. Nobody found out where Rita's father was, but then came Dod, we Nana had when she was well into her 40s, ken. When I was a sprog, Dod I was seemed a real spooky dude. You'd go up to Nana's on a Saturday, like, say, for your tea, and there'd be this nasty young black cat staring at everybody before creeping off, like, say, round the skirting boards. They all said that Dod had this chip on his shoulder, and I thought so and all, until I began to suss the kind of abuse the gadge was taking, at school and in the streets and all that. It was nobody's business, I can tell you, man. I sort of just laugh when some cats say that racism's an English thing, and we're all Jock Tamson's bairns up here. It's like see pure shite, man. Gadges talking through their arses. There's a strong tea leaf tradition in my family, likesy, ken. All my uncles are on the jury. It was I was likesy Dod that got the heaviest sentences for the pettiest crimes, ken. A fundamentally unsound gig, man. Rents once says, there's nothing like a darker skin tone to increase the vigilance of the police and the magistrates. Too right. Anyway, me and Dod decide to hop on down to the Percy for a pint. The pub's a wee bit crazy. Normally the Percy's a quiet family-type pub, but it's mobbed out the day with these orange cats for the Wild West, who are through here for their annual march and rally at the Links. These cats, it has to be said, have never really bothered us. But I can't take them. It's all hate, like you can. Celebrating old battles seems like, see, well, pretty doss, ken. I see Rents' old man with his brars and nephews. Rents' brar, Billy, he's there and all. Rents' old boy's a soap dodger and a Paris bun, but he's no really into this sort of gig anymore. His family fae Glesky sure are, though, and his family seems to matter to Rents' papa. Rents doesn't hit off with these cats. Really, sort of hates them, likesy. Doesn't like talking about them. Different story with Billy, though. He's into all this orange stuff, this sort of Jambo Hun gig. He gives us a nod for the bar, but but I don't think the cat really digs us, but... All right, Danny, Mr. R says. Sound, Davy, sound lights. Heard from Mark? No, he must be doing all right. Only time you hear from that one is when he's after something. He's only half joking, and these young nephew kittens are looking us over in a bad way, so we get a seat in a corner by the door. Bad move. We're in the vicinity of some unsound-looking cats. Some are skinheads, some aren't. Some have Scottish, other English or Belfast accents. One guy's got a screwdriver t-shirt on. Another's likes he wearing an Ulster is British tope. They start singing a song about Bobby Sands, slagging him off likes he. I don't know much about politics, but Sands to me seemed a brave dude likes. We never killed anybody. Likes he, it must take courage to die like that, Ken. Then one guy, the screwdriver dude, seems frantically trying to gee us the stare, as desperately as we're trying to avoid eye contact, lights he. It's no that easy when they start singing Ain't No Black in the Union Jack. We stay cool, but this cat won't be denied. His claws are out. He shouts over at Dodd. Oi! What you fucky looking at, nigger? Fuck you, Dodd sneers. It's a route the cat's travelled down before. No me, though. This is fucking, like say, heavy. I hear some Glasgow boy saying that these guys, like say, aren't they real orange men. They're Nazis and that. But mace to the orange bastards present a lapping these cunts up, encouraging them, like say. They all start singing, you black bastard, you black bastard. Dodd gets up and goes over to their table. I just see Screwdriver's mocking, distorted face change when he realises, at the same time as I do, that Dodd's got a heavy glass ashtray in his hand. This is violence. This is bad news. He thrashes a screwdriver dude's head with it, and the boy's dome sort of splits open as he falls off his stool onto the flare. I'm sort of shaking with fear, raw fear, man. And one guy jumps at Dodd, and they've got him down, so I have to steam in. I pick up a glass and chin red heady Ulster, where he huds his head, even though the glass likes he doesn't even break. But some cunt punches us in the guts with such a sharp force it feels like I've been stabbed, man. Kill that Fenian bastard, some cunt says, and they've got us pinned against the wall likes. I just starts lashing out with fists and boots, no feeling anything. And I'm sort of likes enjoying myself, man, because this is like, see, no like the real violence when you see somebody like Begbie gone rage or that. It's like, see, comic stuff. Cause I can't really fight likes, but I don't really think these dudes are great shakes either. It's like they all seem to be getting in each other's road. I don't really know what happened. Davy Renton, Rents's dad, and Billy's bra must have pulled them off of us, cos next thing I'm sort of standing, pulling Dodd, who looks well fucked, outside. I hears Billy saying, get him out, Spud, just get him down the fucking road. Now I feel really sair all hour, and I'm sort of greeting like tears of anger and fear, but mostly frustration. This is, Lightsy, fuck, this is, Dodd's been chibbed. I gets him out of the road. I can hear people shouting behind us. I just focus on Nana's door, no daring to look back. We're in. I gets Dodd up the stair. He's bleeding for his side and his arm. I phones an ambulance as Nana's cradling his head saying, they're still fucking doing it to you, son. When will they leave you alone, my laddie? Since he was at school, since he was at the bucking school. I'm dead fucking angry, man. But at Nana, Ken, well, being like she Dodd, you'd think that Nana would ken how anybody that's different, that sort of stands out like she feels, Ken. Like see the woman with a wine stain and that. But it's all hate with some punters. And where does it get us, Lightsey man? Where the fuck does it get us?
A chum's towed to the hospital. His wounds were, Lightsey, no as bad as they looked. I goes in to see him lying on a trolley after they've, like, patched him up. It's all right, Danny. I've had a lot worse in the past, and I'll have a hell of a lot worse in the future. Didn't he say that, man? Didn't he say that, Ken? He looks at us like I'll never really understand, and I ken that he's probably right.
Chapter 17. The First Shag in Ages. They had spent most of the day getting stoned out of their boxes. Now they were getting pished in a tacky chrome and neon meat market. The bar is fussy in its range of overpriced drinks, but it misses by miles the cocktail bar sophistication it is aiming at. People come to this place for one reason and one reason only. However, the night is still relatively young, and the camouflage of drinking, talking, and listening to music does not, at this point, seem too obvious. The dope and drink has fueled Spud and Renton's post-junk libidos to a rampant extent. To them, every woman in the place seems to look outstandingly sexy. Even some of the men do. They find it impossible to focus on one person who might be a potential target, as their gaze is constantly arrested by someone else. Just being here reminds the both of them how long it has been since they'd had a shag.
"If you can't get a Joe McBride in this place, you might as well call it a day," Sick Boy reflects, his head bobbing gently to the sounds.
Sick Boy can afford detached speculation, speaking, as he generally does in such circumstances, from a position of strength. Dark circles under his eyes attest to the fact that he has just spent most of the day shagging these two American women, who are staying at the Minto Hotel. There is no chance of either Spud, Renton, or Begbie making up a foursome. They are both going back with Sick Boy and Sick Boy alone. He is merely gracing them with his presence.
"They've got excellent coke, man. I've never had anything like it," he smiles.
"Morningside speed, man," Spud remarks.
"Cocaine. Fucking garbage. Yuppie shite."
Although he has been clean for a few weeks, Renton has the smackhead's contempt for all other drugs.
"My ladies are returning. I'll have to leave you gentlemen to your sordid little activities." Sick Boy shakes his head disdainfully, then scans the bar with a haughty, superior expression on his face.
"The working class is at play," he derisively snorts. Spud and Renton wince.
Sexual jealousy is an inbuilt component in a friendship with Sick Boy. They try to imagine all the cocaine-crazed sex games he'll be playing with the Manto at the Minto, as he refers to the women. That is all they can do. Imagine. Sick Boy never goes into any details about his sexual adventures. His discretion, however, is only observed in order to torment his less sexually prolific friends, rather than as a mark of respect for the women he gets involved with. Spud and Renton realize that three-in-a-bed scenes with rich tourists and cocaine are the preserve of sexual aristocrats like Sick Boy. This shabby bar is their level. Renton cringes as he observes Sick Boy from a distance, thinking about the bullshit that is inevitably coming out of his mouth. At least with Sick Boy, it is to be expected. Renton and Spud are horrified to note that Begbie has bagged off. He is chatting to a woman who has quite a nice face, Spud thinks. But a fat arse, Renton bitterly observes. Some women, Renton considers with a malicious envy, are attracted to the psychopathic type. They generally pay a high price for this flaw, leading horrible lives. As an example, he smugly cites June, Begbie's girlfriend, who is currently in hospital having their child. Proud that he didn't have to go far to make his point, he takes a swig of his Beck's, thinking, I rest my case. However, Renton is going through one of his frequent self-analytical phases, and this smug complacency soon evaporates. Actually, this woman's arse isn't that fat, he reasons. He notes that he is operating his self-deception mechanism again. Part of him believes that he is by far the most attractive person in the bar, the reason for this being that he can always find something hideous in the most gorgeous individual. By focusing on that isolated ugly part, he can then mentally nullify their beauty. On the other hand, his own ugly bits don't bother him, because he is used to them, and in any case, can't see them. Anyway, he is now jealous of Frank Begbie. Surely, he considers, I can't fall any further from grace. Begbie and his newfound love are talking to Sick Boy and the American women. These women look pretty smart, or at least their tan and expensive clothes packaging does. It nauseates Renton to see Begbie and Sick Boy playing the great mates, as all they generally do is to get on each other's tits. He notes the depressing haste with which the successful, in the sexual sphere as in all others, segment themselves from the failures. That's you and me left, Spud, he observes.
Like, see, yeah, it looks that way, Catboy.
Renton likes it when Spud calls other people Catboy, but he hates being referred to it in that way himself. Cats make him sick.
You can, Spud. Sometimes I wish I was back on the Skag, Renton says, mainly, he thought, to shock Spud, to get a reaction from his hash-stoned, wasted face.
As soon as it comes out, though, he realizes that he actually means it.
Hey, like, say, fucking heavy man, can.
Spud forces some air out from between tightened lips. It dawns on Renton that the speed they'd done in the toilet, which he'd denounced as shite, is now taking effect. The problem with being off smack, Renton decides, is that they are stupid, irresponsible fuckers, taking anything that they can get their hands on, at least with smack. There is no room for all the other crap. He has an urge to talk. The speed is a good lap ahead of the dope and alcohol in his system.
Thing is, though, Spud, when you're into Skag, that's it. That's all you've got to worry about. Ken Billy, my bra likes. He just signed up to go back into the fucking army. He's gone to fucking Belfast, the stupid cunt. I always knew that the fucker was tapped. Fucking imperialist lackey. Ken, what the daft cunt turned round and says to us? He goes, I can't fucking stick Civvy Street. Being in the army, it's like being a junkie. The only difference is that you didn't get shot at so often being a junkie. Besides, it's usually you that does the shooting.
That, seems a bit, fucked up like, man, Ken.
No, but listen now. You just think about it. In the army, they do everything for the daft cunts. Feed them, give the cunts cheap bevy and scabby camp clubs to keep them from going into tune and lowering the fucking tone, upsetting the locals and that. When they get into Civvy Street, they've got to do it all for themselves.
Yeah, but it's different, though, cause...
Spud tries to cut in, but Renton is in full flight. A bottle in the face is the only thing that could shut him up at this point. Even then, only for a few seconds.
Wait a minute, mate. Hear us out. Listen to what I've got to say here.
What the fuck was I saying?
Aye, right. When you're on junk, all you worry about is scoring. Off the gear, you worry about loads of things. Need money, can I get pished? Got money, drinking too much. Can he get a bird? No chance of a ride. Get a bird, too much hassle. Can he breathe without her getting on your case? Either that, or you blow it and feel all guilty. You worry about bills, food, bailiffs, these jambo Nazi scum beating us, all the things that you couldn't give a fuck about when you've got a real junk habit. You've just got one thing to worry about, the simplicity of it all. Get what I mean?
Wrench stops to give his jaws another grind.
Yeah, but it's a fucking miserable life, Lacey, man. It's nae life at all, Ken. Lacey, when you're sick, man, that is the fucking lowest of the low. The grinding bones, the poison, man, the pure poison.
Dinna tell us you want all that again, cos that's lacy fucking bullshit.
The response packs a bit of venom, especially by Spud's gentle laid-back standards. Renton notes he's obviously touched a nerve.
Aye. I'm talking a load of shite. It's a Lou Reed.
Spud gives Renton the kind of smile that would make old wifeys in the street want to adopt him like a stray cat. They clock sick boy preparing to leave with Annabelle and Louise, the two Americans. He'd spent his obligatory half-hour boosting beggar's ego. That is, Renton decides, the sole function of any mate of Begbie's. He reflects on the insanity of being a friend of a person he obviously dislikes. It was custom and practice. Begbie, like junk, was a habit. He was also a dangerous one. Statistically speaking, he reflects, you're more likely to be killed by a member of your own family or a close friend than by anyone else. Some tubes surround themselves with psychomates, imagining that this makes them strong, less likely to get hurt by our cruel world, when obviously the reverse is true. On his way out the door with the American women, sick boy turns back, raising one eyebrow at Renton, Roger Moore style, as he vacates the bar. A speed-induced flash of paranoia hit Renton. He wonders if perhaps sick boy's success with women is based on his ability to raise the one eyebrow. Renton knows how difficult it is. He'd spent many an evening practicing the skill in front of the mirror, but both brows kept elevating simultaneously. The amount of drink consumed and the passage of time conspired to concentrate the mind. With an hour to go before closing time, somebody you wouldn't think about getting off with becomes acceptable. With half an hour left, they are positively desirable. Renton's wandering eyes now keep stopping at this slim girl with straight, longish brown hair, slightly turned up at the edges. She has a good tan and delicate features tastefully picked out by makeup. She wears a brown top with white trousers. Renton feels the blood leave his stomach when the woman puts her hands in her pockets, displaying visible panty lines. That is the moment for him. The woman and her friend are being chatted up by a guy with a round, puffy face and an open-neck shirt which strains at his bloated guts. Renton, who has a cheerfully undisguised prejudice against overweight people, takes the opportunity to indulge it.
Spud, take the fat Raj, gluttonous bastard. I didn't go for all that shit about being a glandular or metabolic thing. You didn't see any fat bastards on TV for Ethiopia. Did they no have glands over there? Stroll on.
Spud just responds to his outburst with a stone smile. Renton thinks the girl has taste, because she cold shoulders the fat guy. He likes the way she does it, assertively and with dignity, not making a real arse out of him, but letting him know in no uncertain terms that she isn't interested. The guy smiles, extends his palms and cocks his head to the side, accompanied by a volley of derisive laughter from his mates. This incident makes Renton even more determined to talk to the woman. Renton gestures to Spud to move over with him. Hating to make the first move, he is delighted when Spud starts talking to her mate, because Spud never normally takes the initiative in that way. The speed's obviously helping, however, even though he is somewhat distraught to hear that Spud is rabbiting on about Frank Zappa. Renton tries an approach he considers is relaxed but interested, sincere but light.
Sorry to butt into your conversation. I just wanted to tell you that I admired your excellent taste in kicking that fat bastard into touch just now. I thought that you might be an interesting person to talk to. If you tell us to go the way of the fat bastard, I won't be upset, though. I'm Mark, by the by.
The woman smiles at him in a slightly confused and condescending way, but Renton feels that it at least beats fuck off by a good few furlongs. As they talk, Renton begins to get self-conscious about his looks. The speed kick is running down a little. He worries that his hair looks daft, dyed black, as his orange freckles, the curse of the red-headed bastard, are prominent. He used to think that he looked like the Ziggy Stardust era Bowie. A few years ago, though, a woman told him that he was a dead ringer for Alec McLeish, the Aberdeen and Scotland footballer. Since then, the tag had stuck. When Alec McLeish hangs up his boots, Renton has resolved to travel up to Aberdeen for his testimonial as a token of gratitude. He remembers an occasion where Sick Boy shook his head sadly and asked how some cunt who looked like Alec McLeish could ever hope to be attractive to women. So Renton has dyed his hair black and spiked it in an attempt to shed the McLeish image. Now he worries that any woman he gets off with will laugh her head off when he removes his clothes and she is confronted with ginger pubes. He has also dyed his eyebrows and thought about dyeing his pubic hair. Stupidly, he had asked his mother for her advice. "Dinna be so fucking silly, Mark," she told him, nippy with the hormonal imbalance caused by the change in life. The woman is called Diane. Renton thinks that he thinks she is beautiful. Qualification is necessary, as his past experiences have taught him never to quite trust his judgment when there are chemicals racing around in his body and brain. The conversation turns to music. Diane informs Renton that she likes the Simple Minds, and they have their first mild argument. Renton does not like the Simple Minds. The Simple Minds have been pure shite since they jumped on the committed passion rock bandwagon of U2. I've never trusted them since they left their pomp rock roots and started all this patently insincere political with a very small P stuff. I love the early stuff, but ever since New Gold Dream, they've been garbage. Oh, this Mandela stuff is embarrassing. Puke, he rants. Diane tells him that she believes they are genuine in their support of Mandela and the movement towards a multiracial South Africa. Renton shakes his head briskly, wanting to be cool, but hopelessly wound up by the amphetamine and her contention. I've got old enemies gone back to 1979. Well, I did have, but I flung them out a few years back. And I can recall interviews when Kerr slags off the political commitment by other bands and says that the Minds are just into the music, man. People can change, Diane counters. Renton is a little bit taken aback by the purity and simplicity of this statement. It makes him admire her even more. He just shrugs his shoulders and concedes the point, although his mind is racing with the notion that Kerr has always been one step behind his guru, Peter Gabriel, and that since Live Aid, it's become fashionable for rock stars to want to be seen as nice guys. However, he keeps this to himself and resolves to try to be less dogmatic about his views on music in the future. In the larger scheme of things, he's thinking, it doesn't matter a fuck. After a while, Diane and her pal go to the bogs to discuss and assess Renton and Spud. Diane can't make her mind up about Renton. She thinks he's a bit of an arsehole, but the place is full of them, and he seems a bit different. Not different enough to go overboard about, though, but it was getting late. Spud turns and says something to Renton, who can't hear him above a song by The Farm, which Renton considers, like all their songs, is only listenable if you're E'd out of your box. And if you're E'd out of your box, it would be a waste listening to The Farm. You'd be better off at some rave freaking out to heavy techno sounds. Even if he could have heard Spud, his brain is now too fucked to respond, taking a well-earned rest from holding itself together to talk to Diane. Renton then starts talking personal shite to a guy from Liverpool who's up on holiday, just because the guy's accent and bearing remind him of his mate Devo. After a while, he realizes that the guy is nothing like Devo, and that he was wrong to disclose to him such intimacies. He tries to get back to the bar, then loses Spud, and realizes that he's well and truly out of it. Diane becomes just a memory, a vague feeling of intent behind his drug stupor. He goes outside to get some air, and sees Diane about to enter a taxi on her own. He wonders with a jealous anguish if this means that Spud's bagged off with her mate. The possibility of being the only one not to bag off horrifies him, and sheer desperation propels him unself-consciously towards her.
Diane, mind if I share your Joe Baxi?
Diane looks doubtful.
I go to Forrester Park. Barry, I'm headed that direction myself,
Renton lied, then told himself, well, I am now. They talked in the taxi. Diane had had an argument with Lisa, her pal, and decided to go home. Lisa was, as far as she knew, still bopping on the dance floor with Spud and some other cretin, playing them off against each other. Renton's dough was on the other cretin. Diane's face took on a cartoon sour look as she told Renton what a horrible person Lisa was, cataloguing her misdemeanours, which to him seemed petty enough, with a venom he found slightly disturbing. He was appropriately crawling, agreeing that Lisa was all the selfish pricks under the sun. He changed the subject, as it was bringing her down, and that was no good to him. He told her jocular stories about Spud and Begbie, sanitizing them tastefully. Renton never mentioned Sick Boy, because women liked Sick Boy, and he had an urge to keep the women he met as far away from Sick Boy as possible, even conversationally. When she was lighter-hearted, he asked her if she minded if he kissed her. She shrugged, leaving him to determine whether this indicated indifference or an inability to make up her mind. Still, he reasoned, indifference is preferable to outright rejection. They necked for a bit. He found the smell of her perfume arousing. She thought that he was too skinny and bony, but he kissed well. When they came up for air, Renton confessed that he didn't live near Forrester Park. He only said that so that he could spend more time with her. In spite of herself, Diane felt flattered.
"Do you want to come up for a cup of coffee?" she asked.
"That would be great," Renton tried to sound casually pleased rather than rapturous.
"Only a coffee, mind,"
Diane added, in such a way that Renton struggled to determine what sense she was defining terms in. She spoke slyly enough to put sex on the agenda for negotiation, but at the same time assertively enough to mean exactly what she said. He just nodded like a confused village idiot.
"We'll have to be really quiet. There's people asleep," Diane said.
This seemed less promising, Renton thought, envisaging a baby in the flat with a sitter. He realized that he'd never done it with anybody that had had a baby before. The thought made him feel a bit strange. While he could sense people in the flat, he couldn't pick up that distinctive smell of pish, puke and powder that babies have. He went to speak.
"Diane, shh! They're asleep!"
Diane cut him off.
"Don't wake them, or there'll be trouble." "We's asleep," he whispered nervously. "Shh!"
This was disconcerting for Renton. His mind raced through past horrors experienced firsthand and from the accounts of others. He mentally flipped through a grim database which contained everything from vegan flatmates to psychotic pimps. Diane took him through to a bedroom and sat him down on a single bed. Then she vanished, returning a few minutes later with two mugs of coffee. He noted that his was sugared, which he usually hated, but he wasn't tasting much.
"Are we going to bed?"
she whispered with a strangely casual intensity, raising her eyebrows.
That would be nice," he said, almost spluttering out some coffee.
His pulse raced, and he felt nervous, awkward, and virginal, worrying about the potential effects of the drug and alcohol cocktail on his erection.
"We'll really have to be quiet," she said.
He nodded. He quickly pulled off his jumper and T-shirt, then his trainers, socks and jeans. Self-conscious of his ginger pubes, he got into bed before sliding his underpants off. Renton was relieved to get hard as he watched Diane undress. Unlike him, she took her time and seemed completely unself-conscious. He thought that her body looked great. He couldn't help a football mantra of "here we go" playing repeatedly in his head.
"I want to go on top of you," Diane said, throwing back the covers, exposing Renton's ginger pubes.
Fortunately, she didn't seem to notice. Renton was pleased with his cock. It seemed so much bigger than usual. This was probably because, he realised, he'd become accustomed to not seeing it erect. Diane was less impressed. She'd seen worse, that was about it. They began touching each other. Diane was enjoying the foreplay. Renton's enthusiasm for this was a pleasant change from most of the guys she'd been with, but she felt his fingers go to her vagina and she stiffened and pushed his hand away. "I'm well lubricated enough," she told him. This made Renton feel a bit numb. It seemed so cold and mechanistic. He even thought at one stage that his erection had started to subside, but no, she was lowering herself onto it, and it was, miracle of miracles, holding firm. He groaned softly as she enclosed him. They started moving slowly together, penetrating deeper. He felt her tongue in his mouth, and his hands were lightly feeling her arse. It seemed it had been so long. He thought that he was going to come straight away. Diane sensed his extreme excitement. "Not another useless prick, please, no," she thought to herself. Renton stopped feeling her and tried to imagine that he was shagging Margaret Thatcher, Paul Daniels, Wallace Mercer, Jimmy Savile, and other turn-offs, in order to bring himself off the boil. Diane took the opportunity and rode herself into a climax, Renton lying there like a dildo on a large skateboard. It was only the image of Diane biting into her forefinger in an attempt to stifle the strange squeaks she made as she came, her other hand on his chest, that caused Renton to get there himself. Even the thought of rimming Wallace Mercer's arse couldn't have stopped him by that time. When he started to come, he thought that he'd never stop. His cock spurted like a water pistol in the hands of a persistently mischievous child. Abstinence had made the sperm count go through the roof. It had been close enough to a simultaneous climax for him to have described it in such a way, had he been one to kiss and tell. He realized the reason he'd never do this was because you always get more stud credibility from the enigmatic shrug and smile than from divulging graphic details for the entertainment of Radges. That was something he'd learned from Sick Boy. Even his anti-sexism was therefore overlaid with sexist self-interest. Men are pathetic cunts, he thought to himself. As Diane dismounted him, Renton was drifting off into a blissful sleep, resolving to wake in the night and have more sex. He would be more relaxed, but also more active, and would show her what he could do, now that he had broken this bad run. He compared himself to a striker who had just come through a lean spell in front of goal and now couldn't wait for the next match. He was therefore cut to the bone when Diane said, "You have to go." Before he could argue, she was out of the bed. She pulled on her pants to catch his thick spunk as it started to leave her and trickle down the insides of her thighs. For the first time, he began to think about unprotected penetrative sex and the HIV risk. He'd taken the test, after he'd last shared, so he was clear. He worried about her, however, thinking that anyone who would sleep with him would sleep with anybody. Her intention to banish him had already shattered his fragile sexual ego, turning him from cool stud back into trembling inadequate in a depressingly short time. He thought that it would just be his luck to get HIV from one shag after sharing needles, although never the large communal syringes favoured in the galleries, over a period of years. "But can I no stay here?" He heard his voice sound puny and biscuit-erst, in tones that Sick Boy would mock mercilessly had he been present. Diane looked straight at him and shook her head. "No, you can stay on the couch, if you're quiet. If you see anybody, this never happened. Put something on." Once again self-conscious of his incongruously ginger pubic hair, he was happy to oblige. Diane led Renton through to the couch in the front room. She left him shivering in his underpants before she returned with a sleeping bag and his clothes. "Sorry about this," she whispered, kissing him.
They necked for a bit, and he started to get hard again. When he tried to put his hand inside her dressing gown, she stopped him.
"I have to go," she said firmly.
Diane departed, leaving Renton feeling empty and confused. He got onto the couch, pulled a sleeping bag around him and zipped up. He lay awake in the dark, trying to define the contents of the room. Renton imagined Diane's flatmates to be dour bastards who disapproved of her bringing someone back. Perhaps, he decided, she didn't want them to think that she would pick up a strange guy, bring him back, and just fuck him like that. He bolstered his ego by telling himself that it was his sparkling wit and his unique, if flawed, beauty which had swept her resistance away. He almost believed himself. Eventually, he fell into a fitful sleep, characterized by some strange dreams. While he was prone to such weird dreams, these disturbed him as they were particularly vivid and surprisingly easy to recall. He was chained to a wall in a white room lit by blue neon, watching Yoko Ono and Gordon Hunter, the Hibs defender, munching on the flesh and bones of human bodies, which lay dismembered on a series of large formica-topped tables. They were both hurling horrendous insults at him, their mouths dripping with blood as they tore at strips of flesh and chewed heartily between curses. Renton knew that he was next on the tables. He tried to do a bit of crawling to Gibbsy Hunter, telling him that he was a big fan of his, but the Easter Road defender lived up to his uncompromising tag and just laughed in his face. It was a great relief when the dream changed and Renton found himself naked, covered in runny shite and eating a plate of egg, tomato and fried bread with a fully clothed sick boy by the Water of Leith. Then he dreamt that he was being seduced by a beautiful woman who was wearing only a two-piece swimsuit made out of Alcan foil. The woman was in fact a man, and they were fucking each other slowly through different holes in their bodies, which oozed a substance resembling shaving foam. He woke to the sound of cutlery clinking and the smell of bacon frying. He caught a glance of the back of a woman, not Diane, disappearing into a small kitchen which was just off the living room. Then he felt a spasm of fear as he heard a man's voice. The last thing Renton wanted to hear, hungover, in a strange place, wearing only his kecks, was a male voice. He played at being asleep. Surreptitiously, under his eyelids, he noted a guy about his height, maybe smaller, edging into the kitchen. Although they spoke in low voices, he could still hear them. "So Diane's brought another friend back," the man said. Renton didn't like the slightly mocking intonation on the term friend. "But shush! Don't you start being unpleasant and jumping to the wrong conclusions again." He heard them coming back into the front room, then leaving it. Quickly he pulled on his T-shirt and jumper. Then he unzipped the bag and threw his legs off the couch and jumped into his jeans almost in one movement. Folding the sleeping bag neatly, he stuck the settee's displaced cushions back where they belonged. His socks and trainers were smelly as he put them on. He hoped, but in a futility that was obvious to him, that nobody else had noticed. Renton was too nervy to feel badly wasted. He was aware of the hangover, though. It lurked in the shadows of his psyche like an infinitely patient mugger, just biding its time before coming out to stomp him. "Hello?" The woman who wasn't Diane came back in. She was pretty, with nice big eyes and a fine pointed jawline. He thought he recognized her face from somewhere. "Hiya. I'm Mark, by the way," he said. She declined to introduce herself. Instead, she sought more information about him. "So you're a friend of Diane's?" Her tone was slightly aggressive. Renton decided to play safe and tell a lie, which wouldn't sound too blatant and therefore could be delivered with some conviction. The problem was that he had developed the junkie's skill of lying with conviction and could now lie more convincingly than he told the truth. He faltered,
thinking that you can always take the junk out of the punter before you can the junkie.
Well, she's more a friend of a friend, you know, Lisa?
She nodded. Renton continued, warming to his lies, finding the comforting rhythm of deceit.
Well, this is actually a wee bit embarrassing. It was my birthday yesterday, and I must confess I got pretty drunk. I managed to